動でお風呂を沸かします。
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Covent Garden. My name is Dan Schreiber. I'm sitting here with Andrew Hunter-Murray, Anna Tyshinsky, and James Harkin. Now, once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, that is Anna.
My fact this week is that it's a common misconception that face mites don't have an anus.
How common?
I know that I've blown it wide open for all of you guys and everyone
disgusting.
Listening.
If I had a quid for every time I'd heard someone on the bus saying, you know that face mites don't have an anus.
I know, right?
It's exhausting.
So we did think they were anusless for a long time.
We did think they were. So
face mites. What are they?
Oh, right. Sorry. Yeah.
Explain.
I suppose I better start from the beginning of this story. So face mites are something that almost everyone with
faces.
If you've got a face, you've got the mites, probably about 90% of people. And they're very small, about like between 1/10 and 1/3 of a millimeter. And so you can't really see them. And they're living sort of like inside your pores in the daytime, so you couldn't see them anyway. But there's been this thing, and honestly, if you look up face mites and you do a website search of New Scientist, of National Geographic, very reputable sources, they all say, interesting thing is, they don't have an anus. And so what they do is they store all their fecal waste in their bodies until they reach death, which does only happen after a few days. And then they just explode it all out. And this is why they're bad for you, because they explode feces on your face. Now, this isn't true. And what's more, we've kind of known this isn't true since the 60s. So there was an electron microscope in the 60s that did identify a face mite anus. But no one believed him or her.
That's amazing. I wonder, would you rather have face mites on your face that had an anus and were constantly pooing on your face, or one that only pooed as a one-off at the end of its life?
Well, I think there was an idea, that it's worse to have them storing up all the poo, because this is where a lot of the bad rep of the face mite comes from. People will put various skin diseases down to face mite infestations.
Oh, really?
And it's partly because they'd say, oh, do you know they build up with poo, so much poo, and then it explodes everywhere. And it's not true. And actually, we don't really have evidence that they do any harm to us at all.
No. Although I found one thing that they might be doing to us. So they've got no protection from ultraviolet light, which is why they have to hide inside the pores. And they can't produce melanin, which is related to, you know, tanning and so on. But they do have the ability to eat our melanin. So human's grin secretes melanin, and then they gobble it up.
That's good. So basically they get a suntan through eating, as opposed to through sunbathing.
Exactly. That's exactly what they
do. Great. Imagine if we could do that. Eating... like a biscuit that tanned us.
They're eating our suntans. Don't you find that?
Oh, they're eating away our suntans.
I think they're eating our suntans.
That's so interesting.
And they're using our suntans to fuel all night sex sessions on our faces.
I know. This is the most
amazing
fact.
This sounds like a Tory party expose.
Can I ask about this massive poo? Is it like fake tan coming onto your face?
Because
it's what they've eaten, right?
Yeah.
There is no massive poo. It's all small poo.
Sorry.
It's all small poo. So let's just quickly mention something you dropped in a second ago, which is the fact that every night when we go to bed, they crawl out of our little pores and they have a big old sex party on our face. And this is happening every night on our children, on our grandparents. It's happening everywhere.
It's quite a cool idea, because nighttime is when humans often have sex. So the idea that when you're having sex, it's likely that loads of face mites are also having sex.
Oh, so they're not even waiting for you to sleep. It's just nighttime.
I think it's just darkness.
Just away from the UV, isn't it?
Right. But also they find that couples pass each other's mites. So while you're having sex, you might pass a mite that's now having sex with another you mite.
I think that's quite unusual for you to pass your mites on to another person, actually.
I think
babies normally get them from their mothers.
From breastfeeding,
And I think any other way of me giving you one of my mites is quite unlikely.
Oh, really?
But it is weird, the idea that our fate mites are basically our own, because, as you say, mostly they come from either vaginal childbirth or breastfeeding, because you get face mites hanging around sometimes in the genitals and the nipples. And then they don't really change unless you are living like face to face with someone, like cheek to cheek with someone for years on end, like my colony is totally different to your guys' colonies at this stage,
amazing.
I guess, right?
It is that is amazing. So you'll have got some mites from your mother, from breastfeeding perhaps, or vaginally, and then they obviously won't live for your whole life. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll have children, and their children will have children, and their children will have children. It's a circle of life. Well, it's more like a straight line of life. Because by the time you die, if you live to an average human age, it will be 1,200 generations from the start.
Wow. Really?
Okay, so the ones that are living as you die will be the great, 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 great 1,200 times from the ones that you got from your mother. And that's the equivalent in humans of when rope was invented and ovens were invented and pottery were invented.
So why aren't they achieving more by the end of my life? Why haven't they got mini laptops on my face that they're working on?
On the sex of face mites, it's quite interesting because their penis is on their back.
Oh. Ooh.
So the male has to sort of get underneath the female to have sex.
Right.
But his...
And sort of give her a piggyback.
Like a piggyback. Yeah,
like a piggyback.
Wow.
And it's really interesting because this is a gene which has changed in the genome called the HOX gene.
Okay.
And if you know the fact which all mammals have got 9 neck bones.
Yeah.
Even a giraffe has got the same number of bones as a shrew or whatever. Uh-huh. That's because of the HOX gene. And the HOX gene is the thing which tells you where all your body parts grow. So that your arms are here and your legs are there and your neck's here and all that kind of stuff. And really, very, very few animals, in fact, this is the first one I've ever seen, where they change the HOX gene, because it's really a hard thing to change because you need all your bits in the right place.
So evolutionarily, at some point, their gene just changed and now their penis is on their back. And,
exactly.
And are you suggesting that if we harness this power, we'll be able to have penises wherever we like?
We could, but then the problem would be that our other body parts would grow in weird places.
Oh, okay. So we've got to find a way of isolating it to give each other like a very sexy piggyback.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What changed for them when their penis went on the
Well,
back?
Actually, the mites have been in the news in the last few weeks because they've checked the genome and they found that the genome has changed quite a lot. And the reason is because they are having sex, but they're having sex with their own cousins and brothers and sisters and stuff like that. Mm. And what they're finding is that they're changing in the way that I said, but also in a way that they're losing lots of their useful powers. If you know what I mean. So things that could save them from ultraviolet, they might have had that in the past, but they're losing it because they don't need it because they have such a nice environment in your face.
They're basically becoming completely dependent on us. They're very clingy. It's like having a partner who suddenly they ditch their whole friendship group. They can't even cook for themselves. And they're developing a completely symbiotic
They do have a penis on the back, though. So
it is worth it.
I think the definition is they're currently classed as external parasites on us. But soon, if this process continues, they will be classed as internal symbionts.
Yeah. So, and also they might be classed as extinct, because if they lose all of these skills to stay alive, then it makes it much more difficult when they get passed on to the next generation.
They also have a 7 clawed organ around their mouth, which when they do eat your sebum, they kind of latch their claws, these claws around their mouth, into you.
Right.
Which is quite cool to imagine.
Just when I was warming to them a little bit.
I love that it's called sebum. Yet we have not seen bum for...
Brilliant.
All these years.
Brilliant. Very good.
How did I not realize that? Yeah.
So mites in general.
Oh, yeah.
There are 5 million different species of mite, I believe. As in, everything's got one. Humans have their own.
At least one.
Every kind of beetle will have its own mite. Mm-hmm. Every plant, soil, ocean, any mammal.
I have a favorite mite.
Oh, great.
Which is the Adactylidium. This is so amazing. Its life cycle, it's in like usually found in the Middle East, and they're basically born pregnant, and they're born in order to die. And so
aren't we all?
It's like human lifespan, but very, very fast. So basically, you've got the mother, and she only ever eats one meal in her whole life, and it is always an egg.
Hard boiled?
An egg. I think it's poached, and it's specifically a poached egg of the thunderfly. Or I think in America you call them a thrip. It just eats one thunderfly egg. And then this keeps her alive. And she inside her has 6 to 10 fertilized eggs ready to go.
Right.
And they hatch inside her. So all her offspring hatch inside her. And it's always one male and then all the rest are females. and then inside the mother, all of her offspring.
Oh,
you know what's
no.
coming. We all know what's coming. Obviously, the one brother shags all the sisters.
A mucky pup.
Impregnates them all. And then once he's got all the sisters pregnant, they eat their way out of the mother.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
So the mother gets eaten from the inside. Up and then the kids are born, already pregnant, obviously.
Right.
And then I guess they just start again. Being eaten from the inside by the pregnant kids inside them.
There are some animals which are just too different to us for us to have anything in common.
Yeah, we wouldn't get along.
No.
Yeah, nothing to talk about at all.
Like if one of them gained human sentience, we just wouldn't like the other person.
If at the dinner party they start up their children bursting through their chest.
At least at the dinner party, all they're eating is an egg.
One egg.
Are you going to have that bread? Oh, great, I'll have that.
Okay, it is time for fact number two, and that is Andy.
My fact is that a robot version of the Mayflower has just completed a human-free voyage from England to America. It went really well, except that it took three goes, had to be towed in manually, and first hit land 400 miles from where the original landed. Yeah.
Still cool.
Still cool, but...
Tom marks for effort,
totally
I think.
Totally disastrous. It was a disaster. So this is a ship. It was a robot ship. It was built by IBM and an organization called ProMare. I think that's how it's pronounced, because it's Mare like the sea. And it was called the Mayflower Autonomous Ship, and it was piloted by AI technology, and apparently the technology worked perfectly. But the really funny thing, I just find it funny, the original Mayflower voyage in 1620 took 10 weeks to get from England to the Americas.
Yeah.
And this was expected to take 3 weeks because they said this is so fast, it's so efficient, it's so AI, it's amazing. And it's first set off in, I think, June 2021. And it eventually landed in, I think, May or June 2022. It took about 60 weeks, basically. It took many times longer than the original Mayflower.
But it has gone back and started again at that point, right? To be fair.
Most of those 60 weeks, it was just waiting to try again.
Right.
For a mechanic. Yeah.
Then, in fairness, it was a research thing, right?
Yes.
And in some ways, it's a way to prove that you can do this for research in the future.
Yeah.
So the idea is that a normal boat, like the Mayflower, most of the boat you're using to keep the people alive who are on the boat. So you need to keep food, you need to give them shelter, you need all this kind of stuff. But if it's an AI boat, you don't need any of that stuff. All you need to do is get from A to B. And so you have loads of extra space to do loads of experiments and put loads of electronics in and loads of scanners and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And in that respect, I think it was something of a success. They managed to get quite a lot of data out of it.
Yeah, exactly. And the whole thing is, what a cool idea as well. Like,
very cool.
Yeah, it took a bit longer. It landed in the wrong spot. Sure, it went back three times.
Broke down a lot,
caused nightmares. But
it's called Pro Mares.
Oh, there we go.
What a nightmare.
But it's got a great website as well, should say.
Well, it did crash three times, and then you ended up on bbc.co.uk.
Yeah.
But.
The boat itself had microphones on the hull, with the part of the research capacity, so it was listening for whales as it travelled, and it also had a smart tongue. It had a tongue on the bottom.
That sounds like someone's Tinder profile, or...
I got a smart tongue.
No, that's too rude, isn't it?
No, it sounds more like a mite's penis. It sort of migrated from the wrong side to sort of under the keel.
It was recording the chemical composition of the ocean.
Yeah.
So I think in that sense, it was in the right place.
Right.
Yeah. 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 For sure.
So travel. Before we invented this, though, there used to be sailors who would have to lay at the bottom of a boat with their tongue out through a hole.
Still salty.
We're not in the river yet.
I think it seemed like the conclusion of this voyage was AI works quite well, but it turns out humans still don't know how to make boats. Right?
I think that's
boats. Boats break down
boats
all the
very
time.
Hard. Yep.
Boats really crap. They're always breaking. And this seems to be a problem with AI generally, is that it can work very well, but if stuff goes wrong around it, it can't fix it. And it made me think, next time I go on a ferry, I'll have newfound respect for the people I think are doing nothing. Because stuff just breaks all the time.
So you'll stop telling them.
Name and shame these people who you think are doing nothing. Are you talking about the people manning like the kiosk for snacks? Because they're doing an important job, keeping the people
like
on the boat
alive. Like health and safety officers.
They're crucial, the health and safety guys, the mechanics who are necessary.
What about the guys in the car parking bit who are saying, no, bring it in, left, 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 left.
No, not that far left.
Bending are really important.
Reverse, reverse. Oh, it's in.
Those are some of the most skilled people on the planet, I would say.
Do
people
you know
who
what?
Can fill a ferry.
The,
that bit of the ferry where you drive into is one of my favourite smells.
Oh,
in the
that
world.
Oil.
It's like oily and petrolly, and it smells like trucks.
It's very petrochemical.
I really like that smell anyway, but it reminds me of holidays as a child and stuff.
As a result of that smell, the guys who are doing the car parking, they're as high as kites the whole time. Like they're in an altered consciousness where they can see Tetris happening.
That's the thing is, I thought I'd run over this guy, but it turned out he had his tongue through a hole in the floor.
Did you guys see the picture of the robot Mayflower when it was pulling in, docking in, when it finally landed at Plymouth, which it did eventually? So it left from Plymouth, as the original Mayflower did. Yeah. It
England,
ended up
Plymouth.
Going in Plymouth, England, and then it ended up accidentally somewhere in Canada, where Halifax. But then it did get to Plymouth in the end. But it looks so pathetic because it pulls in next to the Mayflower 2, which is the exact replica of the Mayflower that was built in the 1950s, which I didn't know about. But that's obviously stunning. It's got all this, like, you know, got all the rigging. It's like triple masted. And then it's got this crappy, it's like a catamaran, really, isn't it?
It
was a trimaran outrigger, tiny thing. It looks like Thunderbird 3, I thought.
Yeah, they didn't make much of an effort,
I think there was a suggestion before they made it that, oh, should we make another replica of the Mayflower and send it across? And then they decided, no, let's try and do something for the next few centuries. You know, that's looking to the past if we did that, had another replica.
Exactly,
so I think it is a really, it's a brilliant project and, you know, well done everyone involved.
It is really cool.
Is
the Mayflower 2, when that originally went out in the 50s, they had problems as well on the way and they had to divert. And during the diversion, they went across Bermuda and they almost sank in the Bermuda Ocean.
Really?
So it could have been a Bermuda Triangle casualty, but they didn't, and so it's not a good story.
How almost are we talking?
Oh,
almost?
They just had, they had a bit
like
of trouble.
They had to bucket out a bit of water?
No, there was a big storm, and so it was, you know, you could go.
Oh, yes, there was, wasn't there?
Yeah.
That journey, it was in 1957 they went, and it was this entrepreneur called Warwick Charlton. It was a great name, and he was full of crazy schemes, I guess, all through his life. And he wanted to thank the Americans for their help during the Second World War. So he said, let's build another version of the Mayflower and sail it across. And they did it in quite an authentic way. So they had one radio only. That was the only concession to modernity, I guess. You know, they had no radar. They had no supplies dropped in. They wore pilgrim outfits on Sundays. They didn't want to do the whole thing as a cosplay.
Yeah.
And then after it was arrived, it was officially welcomed by Richard Nixon.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. It sounds so frustrating recreating, like hand forging the individual nails with which they make it, hand sewing the canvas sails, because that's how they did it. They must have thought at some points, what the fuck is the point in this? And apparently, according to the Wikipedia page, and this is taken from a pamphlet that's issued by the Plymouth Museum in Massachusetts, which is where it is now, when they built this replica in England, they employed the skills of elderly traditional workmen so that they could build a vessel that reflected the original.
But how old were they?
That's insulting. You look like you're alive in 1620.
And do you know the one difference between the... It's not the one difference, there are others, but a difference between the Mayflower original and Mayflower 2?
Oh, toilet facilities,
A good one.
Would you? I bet the toilets weren't that much more up to date. Okay.
Electricity...
No, although that I think there was a little bit of electricity on the
To power the radio, which I'm going to say is the other.
So there were lots of differences.
Yep, okay.
One of them was no women allowed on Mayflower 2.
Oh really?
Yeah. Why? That feels a bit regressive.
Well,
Not allowed.
Not
allowed.
Not allowed because the captain, who's a guy called Alan Villiers.
Bad luck, maybe, because it used to be thought that women on boats was bad luck, wasn't it?
Sort of. He basically said that we won't be having any women because there's no place for. This is 1957, but there's no place for glamour pusses. And he said, "Look, the reason
glamour
women
pusses.
Came,
pusses.
The was, women... was the original Mayflower absolutely stuffed with, you know, Raquel Welch in a fur bikini."
Yeah, and that's why it ended up so badly when they arrived at the other end. They were all shagged out. He said the reason the Mayflower original worked and they had women on board and it was fine was because that back in those days, women were chattels, you know, you just owned them. And they're not now. They talk back and you can't handle them. No women.
Wow, Alan.
And so there were thousands of women who applied to help sail the boat over and were not able to go on the trip.
Wow.
But aside from that, it was a really great
I find it amazing
mission.
On the original Mayflower that you had three women who were pregnant and knew that they would have a baby on the boat.
Yeah.
Mm. Which I think that's hardcore, isn't it? Because you know how long it's going to take. It's going to take you 6 months to get there.
Yeah.
You're less than 6 months pregnant or less than 6 months to go. Yeah. Would you do that?
I don't know. Medical facilities were so shit. I think the further away you can get from them in those days, the better.
Yeah. Middle of the sea is better than anywhere else.
Really
yeah.
interesting. Because you might... Were any of the babies born on the new continent, or were they all born on board?
There was one that was born when the ship was anchored, I think, in Cape Cod. So they called him like the first baby in North America, ignoring the people thousands and thousands of years.
Waiting for them on shore. Hey!
But
You would have thought that they might have said to the mother, if you just hold on a little bit longer, this will be the first pilgrim baby born actually on
exactly
the land.
A bit like how we tried to have our cesarean on the 22nd of the 2nd 2022.
Yes.
Like,
and when you you say we, you mean you and your wife, not you and
you and I. I was looking you dead in the eye when I said that, Andy. Yeah, no, me and my wife. Yeah,
doesn't always work out, does it?
I'm afraid
no.
But then, much like I think you named your child partly after the day they were born. One of the children who was born on the Mayflower was called Oceania, I think.
Oh,
that is a cool name.
After the
That's
ocean.
A brilliant name.
Yeah. Yeah,
better than 14th of February that we called ours.
There was been another Mayflower controversy recently.
Okay.
In 2019.
Yeah.
In Devon, there was this group which announced that they were planning to build a 400th anniversary Mayflower. So 2020. And then they were going to set it on fire.
Oh, yes.
And
this
prompted a row in America. People saying it's very disrespectful.
I can see why.
Yeah, you know. But it wasn't intended as a disrespectful move at all. It was this group in Devon who I want to go and meet. They're called the Great Torrington Cavaliers. And every 5 years, they build a big old structure and then set fire to it.
Right,
they've done it with loads of different things. And it's just their way of raising money for charity.
Yeah, I saw a photo of it. Because they did do it in the end. They did light it up. And
it had knitted rats. They had a Ye Olde one-stop knob shop on board, which I'm pretty sure was an original feature of the Mayflower.
One-stop
knob shop.
What's that mean?
I don't know.
What kind of knobs is it? Doorknobs?
I imagine doorknobs.
No, it'll be all knobs because it's only one stop. For all your knob needs. I'd like to buy a packet of hard knobs, a doorknob.
And Piers Morgan there in the corner.
Anyway, they said it on fire.
That was very cool. Another controversial one was the town of Harwich, which is where the Mayflower was originally constructed. So this is in Essex. They wanted to build a replica Mayflower and send it across again. So this was in 2009. They had a town meeting. They said, how do we commemorate this big 400th anniversary? Someone said, why don't we put up some bunting? And then another person, a dentist called Tom Daly, said, why don't we rebuild the Mayflower and we send it across? And so they all agreed to it and they started raising money for it, and sounds like it was quite a doomed project from the get-go. Because first off, they needed to build a shipyard, which they didn't have, to build the ship. And so that took up a lot of funds. They raised millions and millions in order to get this done. They hired lots of interns to come and build the ship, but they had no training, so I think they went through hundreds and hundreds of these interns that just didn't know what they were doing.
Right. Meanwhile, the guy who suggested putting up some buntings just watching the whole thing going, I told them. So what happened?
Well, they just kept trying to they were investing the money that they kept bringing in. They kept building up more money, and people were doing things like sponsoring ship bolts so that they could have their own ship bolt on the ship and so on. Okay. And eventually they just ran out of money.
How much of the ship did they build?
I think they did the keel and like the bow, and then that was it. Yeah. And then obviously all these people that had these plans anyway for the big anniversary couldn't do anything about it because COVID hit, and so all these plans got put into the back seat. So even if they had their ship, it might not even gone at that point.
Oh, that's quite good. I feel like COVID conveniently disappeared a lot of doomed projects. You could just say, well, then COVID, you know. Also, they thought it was a complete stupid idea in the first place.
Okay, it is time for fact number three. That is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that when the first 4 minute miler, Roger Bannister, met his future wife Moira, she knew he was a runner but thought he'd run 4 miles in 1 minute. Many years later, their grandson bragged to his friends that his grandfather could run 1 mile in under 4 seconds.
This is like the Dan process of telling anecdotes. It's exaggerated beyond plausibility.
Well, I should let you know, I am his grandson. one. Been holding that back for years.
So this funny. Is Roger Bannister.
It and his very book. Stupid wife, apparently. Come on, Moira. You've run before.
4 miles in 1 minute.
That's pretty fast.
Silly.
Yeah. So Bannister was a medic as well as a runner, wasn't he? Mm. And, he became Sir Roger Bannister as well because of a load of work that he did for the sports council. So he wasn't just a fast runner. He was... an all-round guy.
He was. I find it amazing that he wasn't even a fast runner after the age of, I think it was 25 when he quit. Yeah. Mm. He just gave up. He said he wouldn't be taken seriously as a doctor. He wanted to be a neurologist, and that's exactly what he became.
Yeah.
And the running he just completely left to one side.
He said that it was only a small section of his life, and if he had to give one or the other up, he would definitely have given running up and would have carried on being a medic, because that was his main part of his life.
It's amazing.
Yeah, that makes
sense. It's quite striking if you read any interview with Roger Bannister. Pretty much the first thing he'll say is, I hate it how everyone bangs on about my running. I don't even care about that. All I want to be known for is being a doctor.
Yeah, should have just run a bit slower, shouldn't he?
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, we wouldn't have been talking about him.
Just add a few seconds on, and you'd be a complete footnote in history.
Nobody would care.
So this happened in Oxford at a place called Iffley Road. Mm-hmm. And
that's his four-minute mile.
That's his four-minute mile that he ran. And the track that he ran it on was actually built partially by him. When he was at university, he helped lay that track down. Yeah, when he did it...
And seems like a bit of a Swiss.
It does, doesn't it? It feels like something's going on.
What do you think he's done? Made it very slippery or something?
Made it downhill, part of it.
A little spring.
Yes.
Lobs him forward. But so he did this, and it was an amazing thing that you can actually watch footage of online, which is pretty incredible. And they talk a lot about his legs, which are very... kind of weirdly spindly, and the sort of big strides that he takes are really interesting, and you can see how knackered he is coming into the end as he does it. In fact, there's a whole crowd waiting for him as he comes right into the end, and he basically collapses into someone's arms as if they knew that was going to happen. They're waiting there to capture him, and then they all stood around to hear had he done it, and there was an official announcement. And he said that the announcer went, the time was 3, and then there was huge eruption because that's what they needed to hear.
Was it McWhirter?
It was Norris McWhirter, the founder of the Guinness World Records, along with Hugh Beaver.
And, apparently we're in a pantomime,
suddenly. Norris McWhirter is a very panto name as well.
And he nearly didn't do it. That morning, he said he spent, because he was training to be a doctor at the time, I think he was a junior doctor, or medical student, and he, that morning, was working and said it was really, really windy. And it was only at the last minute, I think his friend about half an hour before said,
half an hour before.
No, you've got to do it, Rog, come on.
Really? And the wind went. That was the other thing.
The wind went,
and he went, let's do it. But he did it in 3 minutes, 59.4 seconds. Yeah. So we've really taken it to the just under 4 minutes.
In actual fact, I said he was the first 4 minute miler. I should have said under 4 minute miles, right?
Yeah,
he didn't do it in exactly 4 minutes.
Yeah.
But there was someone a few years later, Derek Ibbotson, who in a mile race at White City ran in exactly 4 minutes and 0 seconds.
Wow.
Nice.
So he became the first person to do an exact 4 minute mile.
Would that still have been as exciting to break the record, or is the point that it has to be under 4 minutes?
Yeah, it just had to be under 4 minutes. Okay, it was this invisible barrier that people thought that humans would never be able to get under.
Yeah,
right.
But yeah, we got under it. So getting 4 minutes, actually, if Ibbotson had done that 4 minute mile, arguably he wouldn't have become famous because he hadn't beaten the 4 minute mile.
Yes, and it's pretty, again, when you watch the footage, I do wonder, it's the 50s here that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. What sort of accuracy are we talking about with the stopwatch? Because it was so crowded. What did they have? It was a stopwatch, presumably.
Yeah, I guess I would imagine it was a stopwatch.
Yeah.
I think that as well. I always think, Chris, we accept this so blindly. It's just old Norris sitting there jamming his thumb into the button.
Norris McWhirter.
Good call.
The first woman to run a 5 minute mile, Diane Leather. It was only 23 days after Bannister's record.
Oh, wow.
But didn't get any of the...
plaudits.
Diane Leather's a very good name.
Ran hell for leather.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
That is good.
But in those days, basically, women weren't really supposed to run middle distance running. It was thought to be deleterious to their health.
Was long distance running allowed?
They were only allowed to run over 100 miles or under 100 metres. The IAAF just banned them from running anything more than, I think, 800 metres.
I think we might have said, did we say once in an earlier episode about there was like an 800 100-meter race in the 20s or something where all the women collapsed.
Yeah, we really talked about that. And so that put them off. Well, just because everyone collapses. They collapse in the way that everyone at the end of a long-distance race, like
wobbly
if you've
legs.
Ever seen Mo Farah or someone get to the end of a race, they fall onto the nearest person.
Absolutely.
Very often do. Yeah. And so these women kind of did, some of them.
The IAAF, we should say who they are, the International Amateur Athletics
Federation.
Federation, yeah. Because they did exercise quite a lot of power at the time.
Because this was all do the IAAF.
So Bannister was running as an amateur. That was part of the point of it, I think. And so after he'd run the 4-minute mile, obviously incredibly famous, now one of the most famous people in the world, blah, 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 he went to the USA on a kind of diplomatic, you know, jolly, glad-handing celebrity trip. He was sent by the Foreign Office. But when he got there, the IAAF said that if he was on sponsored TV, that might risk his amateur status. Mm. And therefore, you know, that would be in big trouble. And I don't know if he'd lose a record or whatever. And he was offered a trophy, which was worth £178 when he was in America, because they wanted to reward him somehow. Mm. And the IAAF said, absolutely not. You can accept no gifts worth more than £12 as a result of this.
Cool.
Yeah. Wow.
Becoming the most famous runner.
It was a
runner,
big deal. You know? Like, you couldn't even have expenses to get to places.
Really?
Yeah, and maybe a bit earlier that, but yeah, the amateurism was really important. Yeah.
That was why most of the people who were quite successful runners back in the 50s were quite wealthy white men in Western countries, because you couldn't really afford to do anything like that.
That's true. And actually, there is a thought that there were people who were running sub 4-minute miles before him, but they weren't Oxford graduates who had all the newspapers and everything like that. So, for instance, there's a guy called James Parrott, who's a costermonger, and he supposedly ran a mile in under 4 minutes in 1770. And there was in 1796 someone called Weller who did the same. Mm. And the reason that we think it might be true is because they were bets. So it was like this costermonger said to his mate, I bet you £10 that I can run under 4-minute mile, and the other person paid up. We know that they paid up. So whether they did or not, certainly the person they did the bet with, you know,
convinced
was happy.
That they had. Yeah.
I don't know though, if we're not trusting Norris McWhirter, the stopwatch, I don't know if I'm trusting whatever grandfather clock they timed it
but
by.
But I'm so glad we're on these guys, because I think they're really interesting claims. I love the James Parrott one. Mm. And there was also, soon after him, in 1787, there was a runner called Powell who wagered 1,000 guineas, which is a lot of money. Today it's nearly £800,000.
Wow.
It's a lot. That he could manage a 4-minute mile run. And he claimed to have done it in 4:03 when he did this time trial. It was near Hampton Court in London. And it was 5 days before Christmas. And the really interesting detail is that he was naked at the time. Most serious runners would have been naked when they
in the 1700s.
It was kind of a harking back to ancient Greek athletic culture, but still.
Really?
And so what happened? Did he lose the money?
I actually don't know if he lost or won the money. I actually apparently didn't decide it was worth writing down whether or not he managed.
I did a similar thing. The current record for what the 4-minute mile can be run in. I've got all the other details. Got the guy's name. Just haven't written down what time he did it in. So what does anyone know the current?
It's about 3:50.
It's about 3:50.
Is that Al Gharouge?
Yes, Al Gharouge.
I don't know how much it was. I think it would be less than that, wouldn't it?
I think it's
340 something.
340.
I know what he beat Bannister by in meters, as in if the two of them were racing against each other, how much of a lead he had on him.
That's so weird for you to have collected that piece of information.
Okay, well, tell us, we can work that out.
Yeah, try and work it out.
How many meters was it?
He beat him by 100 meters. He would have crossed the line.
Okay, well, if you think 10 seconds for a really fast runner to run 100 meters, they would have done it in 15 seconds, something like that. So if you take that off 4 minutes, then that's...
Yeah,
you know, 3:45.
You've made it a bit complicated by mixing up meters and miles, obviously, but we can work.
Yeah. But just at home, do the calculation yourself,
or just Google Hicham Al Gharouge.
Yeah.
And find out. 1999, it was. It seems strange that we haven't beaten the world record since then.
Century.
Since 1999, a century.
This century.
Oh, this century. the reason, according to Peter Weyand, who is a Southern Methodist University professor of applied physiology and biomechanics, he reckons that the reason it hasn't been beaten is because the next year we started testing for EPO, which is a banned steroid, which kind of gives
what
you...
What year was that, sorry?
99.
Oh.
And so... The Olympics knew that people were taking EPO, but they didn't have a way of testing for it until a year later. And El Gharouge, I should say, has denied that he's ever taken any drugs, and he is quite vocal in the anti-drugs kind of campaign in sports. So no,
because all the other ones go, yep, I was definitely on it.
But the really interesting thing I think about El Garouj is that he was going to be a football goalkeeper. And as a kid, he was really, really good. But his mum stopped him from doing it because he would dive around in the mud and all of his clothes would get really dirty. And so she said, oh, well, you know, I have to clean them all the time. Can you not do something that's a bit less dirty? And he went, OK, I'll be a runner instead. And he became the best miler ever.
Yeah. Wow. Do you know who came up with the first steroid test for athletes?
Is it someone we'll have heard of?
Norris. Is it Norris?
Yeah, you're really close.
David Hockney.
Oh, Hugh Beaver.
No, it was Bannister, wasn't it?
It was Bannister.
Oh!
Yeah, it was Bannister who developed the first steroid test. This was in 1973, because he was big into, you know, calling out people who took steroids in sports. And other stuff he did, other medical stuff he did, since that's all he wants us to know about him, is he was into self-experimenting. He was one of those doctors.
Really? Okay.
Yep,
on
so...
steroids?
Yeah, later at the age of 45, he ran out 2 minute mile.
Not steroids, with pyrogens, actually, which are less fun. They are chemicals that induce fever. So he wanted to study fever. So he injected himself with pyrogens, and then he sat naked in a hot chamber for 6 hours, which spiked his temperature to very dangerous levels and turned him dark green.
Wow.
What? Dark green?
Yeah,
really? Do we believe that?
Is that not the story of the Incredible Hulk?
And he said, I wouldn't perhaps recommend
Bruce Banner stir?
Oh my god.
Oh, we blow this shit wide open.
So long since we blew something wide open. I'm so glad about that.
Wow.
You'll see in a lot of his papers, he'll refer to the study participant RB. Always him, obviously.
You mentioned earlier, Anna, that he was quite tricky to interview sometimes, because obviously he had these two very different aspects of his life. So there was an interview by The Guardian, I think in the early 2000s, so he was getting on then, but I just wanted to read you some of the...
Yeah, go for
it. Okay, he was asked a few questions, then he said, right, is there anything else you want to know? And the interviewer said, well, I'll be honest, sir, yes. What's your favourite biscuit? Oh, I don't answer questions about biscuits.
Why
not? Oh, no. I'm not into biscuits.
Now, what is he hiding? That's the question.
The interviewer says, everybody likes a nice biscuit. He says, well, I'm not sure what the purpose of that aspect of the interview is. It's quirky, game showy, odd.
Great answers.
Fair play to The Guardian interviewer. He perseveres. Uh-huh. Cheese or chocolate? No. All right, I think you've got more than enough there. What about pie fillings? Steak and kidney or chicken and mushroom? Bannister just says, thank you so much. All the best. Ends the interview.
That's incredible. What year is this?
I think about 2004 it was.
Okay.
Goodness.
I'm just wondering, is this like the era of, like, you know, Dennis Pennis and Ollie G, and everyone's been primed not to answer stupid questions?
I think
questions.
You just hated asking.
I think that's just, think it's a pointless question from a journalist. And that journalist, I can really imagine doing what that journalist has done, which is not be able to remember anything else that you might have asked him. Just having to keep going on.
Or just quickly looking at your notes going, oh, fuck, what's your favourite sandwich?
Would you rather? No, that's not going to work either. Have you ever? No.
Well, I was saying to you guys, bizarrely, my brother helped him write his last autobiography a few years ago, which came out. I think it's called
so
Twin
cool.
Somethings. He said he was extremely nice, and actually, particularly his wife. My brother absolutely loved Moira, and she'd always bring them warm beer and sort of cold cuts for lunch.
Any biscuits?
Well, I read through that book, and there was no mention of Garibaldi. So we went,
"Why not?"
Every time she brought biscuits in, he flipped the table.
I saw him once at the QI used to have a building in Oxford, and he came to one of the parties in
he just ran in, had a drink, ran out.
Yeah,
again.
Exactly. Yeah.
Would you like a biscuit?
No. Yeah, but it was kind of like, I don't know, in a weird way, because he's someone who's a slightly obscure famous person. It was sort of like spotting, you know, like a Bigfoot. It was just like, wow, like, look, a sighting of Bannister.
Do you think, I mean, he didn't like it, but let's say he did like it, would you walk around even in your 80s wearing your shorts and your, like,
tank top thing?
Yeah, tank top thing.
Carrying your record. What did he get?
Medal?
Oh, he was,
must have got a medal.
He was the year before you get the Guinness World Records.
Yeah.
Poor guy.
So he didn't even have the...
Missed it by a year.
No proof.
Because his record was then broken, wasn't it, 46 days later, by John Landy, the Aussie. And they ended up having an amazing run together, which was part of a race which was known as the Miracle Mile Race. So it had a few different names. And they went up against each other. I mean, how exciting. Two guys who had the records trying to see who could beat them.
I suppose that does happen in pretty much every race meeting in the world.
That's true, because you're always trying to break a record. I guess this was the
very Renlo Farrow just racing a bunch of primary school children on sports day. Do you know what? You should try racing other good runners.
But I think Bannister said his race against Landy was the thing he was really proudest of, because it was watched by 40 million people when it was in Vancouver.
And listened by 100 million on the radio, apparently.
Listened to by 100
million. Bizarrely boring. Just bang, 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 bang. Is that what you hear when you listen to a race?
Commentary.
Commentary would probably be.
Commentary,
it's not a good commentator if that's what they're saying the whole time. Bang, 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 bang. So in that race, they were both, you know, neck for neck the entire time, and Bannister's behind him. And
that's not what neck for neck
is. Yeah, so he was kind of like putting his neck out and touching the back of it.
Neck and neck, I think.
Yeah. Not neck for neck.
No.
Neck for neck, an eye for an eye.
That's the Bible, yeah. I think they were neck and neck. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I would not make a good commentator either.
Anyway, they were neck
bang,
and neck.
Bang, 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 bang. Yep, they're neck for neck.
They were neck and neck in front of one in front of the other, yeah.
So Bannister's right behind him, and he's covered up, and on the final corner, Landy looks over left on his shoulder, and as he looks over left, Bannister takes over on the right, and that was the famous moment where...
Did he tap him on the shoulder before he did it?
I want to report a ghost on the running track. I think we need to redo it.
So that was the big moment, and this moment
then
has been...
Then he stole his nose.
And then his thumb came off, and it was like, whoa! Anyway, the prize money that Landy got was retrieved from behind his ear, actually. So. Okay, it is time for fact number four, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that when the movie Ulysses was released in New Zealand in 1967, censors were so worried about it that men and women weren't allowed to watch it at the same time. So they literally had to be placed in different cinemas if they wanted to go and see it. And that continued on for years. So there was a showing of it at a university in New Zealand in 1972. And even then, they allowed men and women in the same room, but they had to sit on either side of the cinema.
Okay, so... Is it because it's so sexy?
It's sexy. It's sweary. It was just Debauch City. It was.
You see, because I can see if it's sexy that you don't want men and women sat next to each other. Mm.
Yeah.
Right.
Because they might have sex with each other.
They might just straight like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's what happened I watched. Stop on my mum watching.
And you weren't on your own to the cinema, did you? So that poor person next to you.
I could see halfway through that sentence that was going nowhere. But then. Like, if it was a sweary part of it, it doesn't make sense if they're in the same room, right?
No, exactly. No, it was a mixture. It was a mixture of the sexiness and of the swearing. And in the room, there was a rope that went down the center of the audience. And so you had the men and women still... There was one row, like one line down the center where men and women could have had sex.
With a rope?
Well, the rope was sort of... There was no aisle between them. They were literally in a seat next to someone. Yeah.
If there's just a piece of rope in between you and a person, you can still have sex.
It's a pretty weak barrier to ardor, I would say.
Yeah, I got this fact, by the way, from a brilliant book called The Land Before Avocado, and it's by a guy called Richard Glover, who I've met in Australia when we were on tour there. I went on his radio show, so he's a big journalist and broadcaster. He's written a bunch of books. And
what's
he listens
the
to fish.
Title referring to?
Well, avocado is absolutely abundant in Australia as a breakfast item, and he's talking about the old Australia. So avocado is sort of the new world of Australia.
Got it.
And the book is all about all the olden days and how things used to be. And Ulysses was actually banned in Australia, which is where it comes up, the book, as well as the movie.
So this is James Joyce's Ulysses, I should say.
Yeah, James Joyce's Ulysses.
You haven't read the book, now don't see the film.
But yeah, so he mentions that it was allowed in New Zealand, but then they had the segregation thing between the men and the
very
women.
Funny.
Yeah.
Wow. And you said that it was the film as well, wasn't it? That was banned in Australia and South Africa, I think. And
quite a lot of places.
It was banned in Ireland.
Yeah.
The ban in Ireland was only lifted in the year 2000.
Yeah.
That is amazing. A long ban. And I think Ireland's Justice Secretary sent his secretary to go and see the movie, yeah. And reported back that if this film was allowed, it would discredit the Irish government, so it can't be permitted.
Mm. Yeah.
It was the first film shown in Britain to feature the F word.
Ooh.
Mm. Spicy. It's really interesting. It was made by a guy called Joseph Strick, and he was a massive fan of the book. So his initial pitch for making the movie was he wanted to do it verbatim. So it was going to be 18 hours long. He wanted every bit of dialogue that was in the book used.
Holy moly.
Got talked out of it, so it eventually ended up being 2 hours long. But then when it came out, he was very angry about the response of all these bannings and the way that people were treating the film. And there was one famous incident where they showed the movie in Cannes at the film festival, and this was at the 1967 one. It had French titles along the bottom, and during the film, where it got to a particularly spicy bit, they had, using their hands, scribbled out the translation in French subtitle of what was being said. So Strick saw this, thought, you're messing with my movie,
yeah.
ran to the projection booth, where he was met by the committee of the film festival, who knew that he'd rush in there. And then he was forcibly ejected, according to him. He said he was pushed down the steps and suffered a broken foot. And so he withdrew the film from Cannes altogether. Wow.
The reason that he loved the book is that his father had smuggled a copy into America because it was illegal in lots of countries at the start of the 20th century. And his father smuggled this copy into America and would just keep it in the house and leave it on the table so that whenever anyone came round, they would say, oh, that's that dirty book, isn't it, like Ulysses. And then like, even though no one had read it, they would still argue about it, about censorship and stuff like that.
Well, it was really, so it's, I think 1920, the very early 20s it was published, 23 I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, it's printed,
I think it was, because he wrote it in 18, didn't he, and it was serialized, but maybe it was published in Britain in 23, do you mean?
Well, 500 copies were burnt at Folkestone in 1923, so I think that was an attempt to import it, and
it was published
well.
In France in 1922. That was in Paris by an American woman called Sylvia Beach. She opened a shop and she had these copies of Ulysses that she managed to get, and she sold them for 10 times more than any other book in the shop, because she knew that everyone would want to get their hands on this book. But still they managed to get them, still they paid for them. And she removed the copy from the store window because she thought that people would start throwing bricks in her store and stuff like that.
Still none of the buyers ever read it, I think we can guarantee. All of these places, all of these people.
Beach was really brave. So the book was sued in New York by the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice, and it was convicted for being obscene.
They were fun people.
But then after that, Beach published it in Paris, and part of the reason it was controversial was when it was printed in extract in the USA, even the printers themselves said, this is outrageous, we're not working on this. And then when she was in Paris, French printers were obviously harder to offend with English filth, because they don't understand the language that they're printing in. So
and
that
they're French, like, you know, Madame Bovary.
Web it through, you know, they're used to this sort of
Madame Bovary's not that sexy.
Are you
There's
joking?
Some shit in a carriage. Come on. It's much more subtle than what Ulysses sounds
it's
like.
It's pretty raunchy stuff, Madame Bovary.
Okay.
Well, Andy's bar still, is quite different to
you. I'm still lobbying to ban Madame Bovary.
But so Nausicaa was the chapter in America that was seen from Ulysses. Right. So they were publishing these extracts. And in the chapter that suddenly raised the concern, Leopold Bloom, one of the lead characters of the book, Ulysses.
The lead, I think.
The lead, the main
he's
guy.
He's not sharing it with many people. Maybe Molly.
I was thinking Molly. So it's a scene in this chapter where he's masturbating on a beach while gazing at a 17-year-old girl called Gertie McDowell, and that's what they took exception to. They have scenes like that in Madame Bovary?
It's not quite that much, is it?
I don't remember. It's been a while since I've read it.
Or, in fact, another scene. And this is just saving anyone the trouble of actually reading it, because we're just telling you the couple of fun bits, so you don't have to bother. But apparently there's one scene in a... I haven't read it. There's one scene in a Dublin brothel where Leopold Bloom transforms into a woman and then gives birth to octoplets before the brothel madame, who then turns into a man and starts auctioning off Bloom's like prostitution services and demonstrates. So Bloom's now a woman with a vagina.
Right.
And so the brothel madame demonstrates how good a prostitute that he'd make by shoving her arm up his vagina.
Yeah. Okay.
Also doesn't happen. Oh, shoves her arm up the vagina and then shoves it into the bidder's face to be like, look, how good is that?
There's another line. I actually started reading Ulysses at the start of the year when my daughter was born, and I had a lot of time in the middle of the night sat there with nothing else to do. And I got through not much of it, but then I started listening to the audiobook, the RTE version, which actually I got through most of. I didn't get through to the end. And it gets really racy at the end, so I'm a bit gutted that I haven't got there yet. But anyway, there was this line, and I did tweet this at the time, which is, "Haynes helped himself and snapped the case too. He put it back in his side pocket and took from his waistcoat pocket a nickel tinderbox, sprang it open too, and having lit his cigarette, held the flaming spunk towards Stephen in the shell of his hands."
What?
And so that's...
Wait, when did the spunk come in before that moment?
The reason is that the word spunk just doesn't mean what it means today.
Oh, really?
It meant like a little bit of flame, or a little bit of, you know, if you light a match, a little bit of flame sort of flies away. That used to be called a spunk.
Flaming spunk.
I guess it is a sort of flyaway thing. It flies off and away.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some etymological reason.
Golly.
Do you know that the day Ulysses was set, which is famously one day, June the 16th, 1904, is the day that James Joyce first got a hand job from his wife?
Is it?
Yeah.
Bloomsday.
It's to commemorate that day. Exactly.
Really? Is it? So that's why it's to commemorate. Yeah,
yeah, he set it then. Point. It was their first date. That's is it to commemorate the first date? Is it to commemorate the hand job? Is there a difference?
Is there? I don't know. But also, Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes married on that day.
Did they?
In commemoration of Bloomsday, not the handjob. more about when the day was set.
Yeah. I wonder if she gave him a handjob in proper commemoration.
You may now kiss the bride, and you may now... Oh. the person who banned the book in the UK, this was in 1922. It was the government that banned it, but the person whose idea it was a guy called Sir Archibald Bodkin. And he issued an official opinion saying that it was a filthy book and it should not be allowed to be imported into the country, and the government agreed. And I was reading about Sir Archibald Bodkin. Apparently, he was a man of unwavering Victorian sensibilities. This is according to an author, Kevin Birmingham, who was writing about Ulysses. And he said, on the rare occasions that he told a bawdy joke, he drained away the humour by delivering the punchline with a disapproving glare.
Why are you looking at me, James? I don't know what you're trying to say here.
I love
that's
that.
That's so funny. God, I'd love to see his live at the Apollo set.
Furious when the audience laughs. Shut up.
Just on films that are banned.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The Wikipedia for which films are banned where is great. So, because it's quite nationally specific in lots of cases. So, Cuba, for example, has banned the films Red Zone Cuba, Cuba Crossing, Red Dawn, Cuban Love.
Any movie with Cuba Gooding Jr.
Without Havana. And finally, Harold and Kumar Escape from Guantanamo Bay.
That's understandable.
There's one film called Titanic from 1943. It's a 1943 Titanic, not the original.
Yeah.
Which was banned by the Nazi government, despite the fact that it had been made by the Nazi propaganda department.
I remember that one. Yeah.
And,
why? Was it like a practice run to check how well they banned stuff?
I think Goebbels decided it would weaken morale because there was lots of bombing happening in Germany at the time, and Goebbels decided that because this film featured a lot of deaths on the Titanic, that it would weaken morale in Germany. So there were some test screenings outside Germany, but it was never shown in Germany. It was also then obviously banned by the Allies because it was Nazi propaganda. So there was basically nowhere this film was allowed to be shown.
Do you guys know the film Too Cool for Christmas?
No.
No.
Not familiar with that.
Do you know the film A Very Cool Christmas?
No.
Right. Well, they're both the same film. They're about a girl who wants to go skiing instead of spending Christmas with her parents. But in one of them, in A Very Cool Christmas, the girl's parents are a female and male heterosexual couple. Mm-hmm. And in Too Cool for Christmas, her parents are two male gay fathers.
Right, okay.
And it's exactly the same. The films are exactly the same as each other. They just refilmed every single scene involving the parents, which I imagine is quite a lot of scenes.
And they just show them in different parts of America or
different parts of the world?
That was pretty much exactly it. It was for America. It was 2004. And it's this director who is called Sam Irvin, who's a gay director who wanted to do the plot line about the gay dads, but couldn't get the budget for the LGBTQ station that he wanted to put it on. So he also sold it to Lifetime TV, a rather traditionalist TV station. So he also got a mum.
I want to go to like a traditional Orthodox American family and show them the first film, the one with the heterosexual couple, and then show them the other one and say, you know what? They've done this for all the films.
The secret archive of every film in the world.
Okay, that's it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with any of us about the things that we've said over the course of this podcast, we can be found on our Twitter accounts. I'm on @Schreiberland, Andy.
@AndrewHunterM.
James.
@JamesHarkin.
And Anna.
You can email podcast@qi.com.
Yep, or you can go to our group account @NoSuchThing or our website, NoSuchThingAsAFish.com. Check it out. All the previous episodes are up there, as well as links to any upcoming live shows that we might be doing. Our merch is up there as well. But most excitingly of all is the new thing that you'll find up there, which is a link to Club Fish. Club Fish is our new subscription service. It's a membership club whereby you can get access to ad-free episodes. You can get all sorts of bonus content that we're going to be popping up there. Or you can just, you know, support the podcast. You might just want to do that. You've been thinking of doing that for a while. This is your way to do it. So whatever your reason for joining Club Fish, we would love to see you there. We hope you enjoy all the behind-the-scenes stuff that we're going to be chucking up there too. But hey, listen, if you can't join Club Fish, don't worry. You don't need to, because this podcast isn't going anywhere. We are not going behind a paywall. This will stay a free weekly podcast for the rest of its days. So the best way you could support us if you don't want to do Club Fish is simply just keep listening. Just keep bringing your ears to the party and maybe tell your friends about it too. We want to be spreading these facts to as many people as possible. And the only way we do that is by having listeners like you tell your friends about it. We will be back again next week with a very special guest. We'll see you then. Goodbye.